Hello, and welcome to Hard Fried History, a hybrid history
and comedy
podcast run by two aspiring entertainers.
Podcast, it's more of a rant, really.
That have failed at almost everything else.
I don't fail because I don't try, so there.
We appreciate you checking us out, and if you want to see extra content, follow us on Instagram or give us a like on Facebook at Hard Fried History.
Subscribe to us on YouTube or tell us we're full of shit on Twitter at HFH Podcast.
Feel like going that extra mile? Give us a 5-star rating on iTunes. Or wherever you're listening, and leave us a flattering, a glowing review.
And of course, tell your friends, family, and even people you don't like about us.
That's right. Again, thank you for listening, and without further ado, the episode. Part 2 of Russia in the 90s. Hey, everyone. Welcome to part 2 of Russia in the 90s. Unless you just, you know, went straight for part 2 because you don't have time to fuck around, which I understand completely.
Okay.
Just a brief refresher for the sources that we use. We got Russia in the 1990s by Irina Lobacheva, 2013. Heroes of the 90s, The Characters, The Money, A New History of Capitalism in Russia by Valeria Bashkirova, Alexander Soloviev, and Vladislav Dorofeyev, 2014. And then Post-Soviet Russia in the Adventurous 1990s, The Wild Decade by Derek Widmer. And last time we left off with some people making a bunch of money and other people starving and having to grow food to supplement the lack of food, or not the lack of food in the grocery store. The food in the grocery stores they are unable to buy, and it's going to be more of that plus some other stuff. So, here we go with Act One, which I will title Second Thoughts. So, in December of 1992, there are growing tensions between this guy Ruslan Khasbulatov and Boris Yeltsin kind of come to a head, and they were more or less pre-existing, but focusing on that month, Yeltsin was like kind of trying to establish the presidency as the supreme power, but the Supreme Soviet of the Russian Federation, which is like their parliament, it can still impeach the president, it could dismiss any minister, it can investigate any minister, they can like request early elections, so they still have a bunch of powers that Boris Yeltsin kind of wants to centralize in his own hair, or at least strip parliament of.
Yeah.
And so that month, December of 1992, Khasbulatov, he tried to amend the constitution to limit presidential power and give parliament the power to form governments. And he like forces Yeltsin to negotiate because those amendments he was trying to pass come very close to passing. And, you know, Yeltsin comes to the table and he basically agrees to sack Yegor Gaidar, the guy who was responsible for all of the shock therapy reforms of prime minister. And then they get this guy, Viktor Chernomyrdin, as the new prime minister of Russia. Okay. But I bring all that up just to show that the tensions are there and they're increasing.
I know. I appreciate your knowledge of Russian names.
Yeah, man, they're rough. You know, the first time I read the shit is it was all just like, all right, let me just learn how to pronounce these ridiculous ass words. You know.
Okay. All right. Well. All right. Don't.
Russian's easier than because they use vowels. You know, you try to pronounce like some Hungarian name or some Czech names, moreover, because I've been watching a bunch of Czech movies lately. Czech names, it'll just be like 4 consonants. And I'm like, I have no idea.
we're going to put that F next to that C and next to that Z. How about that?
Mm-hmm. we're going to put an S next to a Z. I'm just like, this seems redundant to me. Mm-hmm. Just pick one, you know, what are you doing? So March of 1993, there are 2 impeachment attempts orchestrated by Khasbulatov against Yeltsin, and both of them fail, but they hold a referendum, and which gauges presidential support, I believe, in that month of March 1993. Most people supported Yeltsin still and wanted him to stay in power. Yeah. But they did express in the referendum that they weren't really happy with the shock therapy reforms, understandably. Yeah. And then later that year, September 21st, despite the referendum, Boris Yeltsin announces Decree 1400, whereby he defies the Soviet Constitution by dissolving parliament, and he schedules new elections to be held for parliament for December 12th. And there's this like clause in the Soviet Constitution, which I guess they still abided by, because that clause basically says that if the president were to ever use his power to dissolve an organ of the state, he would be, the gist is like he would immediately not hold the office anymore. And so using that clause in the Soviet Constitution, the guys still in parliament, because a lot of their ministers and everything just refuse to leave parliament, or a lot of the legislators refuse to leave parliament, they name Alexander Rutskoy the new president and start impeachment proceedings against President Yeltsin on September 25th of 1993. Basically, you know, just what I just said, Decree 1400 grounds for impeachment, and they, you know, call for elections. Yeah. Rutskoy is president. And so, like, street demonstrations start erupting near parliament, and the police are counter-mobilized, and things are escalating.
What a power move. What a power struggle. Just yeah, man. Like, you're fired. No, you're fired.
You're fired, man. It's never a good thing when you have two people claiming to be president. You know, there's bound to be some destabilization that occurs when two people claim to be president and one person will not give up their claim to the presidency. Right?
At the very worst, whatever relationship you guys have, this is definitely a communications issue.
Mm-hmm.
It's definitely, you guys definitely haven't talked about this. And if you have, nothing got settled. You never really
talked
at each other. You didn't talk
to each other. Did you listen?
Did you listen? Did you listen? Like, did you listen that we didn't like shock therapy?
Hey, man, it really fucked over a lot of people. Yeah. And, you know, most of the people seem to be all right with you, Boris Yeltsin. But, you know, maybe just don't be so insecure, man. Maybe just don't assume that you need to dissolve parliament, bro. We're here. Uh-huh. To where I actually don't know enough about the situation to know if they were like, gonna reimpose communism or whatever. That I've heard that as like something tossed around, but I don't really buy that either.
Oh no, this is like something a NPR podcast that they do for like 8 months. Uh-huh. But it would just be like on this specific subject. Like,
yeah,
this,
yeah.
I'm just
I have no idea. Yeah.
Yeah. Like
the only thing I know about Rutskoy is he has like a wicked stash. That's about it. And he was a member of the Communist Party, and I think he had glasses as well. But that's he looks like a dude my oil baron uncle would hang out with. You know, that's the most I know about Rutskoy.
I mean, look, I've hung out with the oil bros and
the oil bros
about that.
Uh huh.
There's shrimps are getting eaten.
Let's hella shrimps are getting popped right into some moths.
Gullets.
All right,
some gullets. yeah. Mad seafood. and when you, it's like, who's gonna pay for all this? Just put it on a card.
I have a monthly tab here. As a matter of fact, just put it on my tab. They know me. All right, thanks everybody. Yeah. You guys have hey, good job today. Right.
Mm-hmm.
Have a good one, exactly. Everybody. I'll be back. You know.
Everybody knows
a little bit of that. Yeah.
Yep.
Where everybody knows your name.
Okay, that's not how the song goes.
And your name is...
That's not how the song goes.
Ruslan Khasbulatov.
Okay. All right, get it back on track.
Okay. This all culminates. All the escalating tensions culminate on October 3rd of 1993. There are these pro-parliament protesters basically capture riot police trucks and buses, and there's kind of some allegations that, like, it was mighty easy for those protesters to capture, you know, trucks and buses and everything. Maybe there's some shifting loyalties on part of the police here. Maybe they side with a certain side. I don't know. Mm-hmm. And there are shots fired, right? Heard near the office of the Moscow mayor. And to be clear, An investigation in 1998 found that the shots were fired at the protesters and at the windows of Parliament. So some people were, you know, particularly like the pro-Yeltsin guys are saying that, oh, the protesters were shooting at the Moscow mayor. And it's like, no, these were, I don't know if they found anything more than that, but yeah. I know that the investigation said, no, shots were fired at the protesters and at the Parliament where the like impeachment proceedings are taking place. So,
okay.
You know.
Yeah.
Rutskoy, Alexander Rutskoy, the guy with a competing claim to president, valid claim, invalid claim, I'm not going to say, from the window, he's pissed off about these shots being fired. And so he calls for the occupation of City Hall and his forces, which I think they're called like the North Group, quote unquote. Mm-hmm. And they occupy City Hall and they kick out some of the Interior Ministry forces. And then the North Group goes on to occupy the Ostankino TV station led by this guy, General Albert Makashov. Mm-hmm. And he had like a bunch of police trucks and APCs carry protesters there. However, they're not well armed. They're like a bunch of civilians with, you know, it's not only men, it's like some men with their daughters and women. It's mainly like a civilian group. And that's the thing to emphasize. He gets there. And about like 100 pro-Yeltsin police and military guys are there. And Makashov, he's out there negotiating with them like, hey, I got to get on TV real quick. You know, it's my 15 minutes. I got to get this broadcast out there. And he's like, you guys need to get the fuck out of there. And like the main guy that he's negotiating with is like, oh, let me radio this in and see what my orders are because I'm not going to leave without orders. And really, they're just like buying time for reinforcements to arrive.
Yeah.
What ends up happening is the North Group, the guys under Makashov, they like drive a truck into the side of the building and a bunch of civilians occupy the TV station. And there's like a pro-Congress student, like a pro-Parliament, pro-Rutskoy Makashov guy, I believe at least. He's trying to like mount a grenade on top of a grenade launcher.
Yeah.
And he's shot by a special forces roof sniper. And this is the inciting incident. Like, all hell breaks loose. You have all of these civilians who are now, like, cooped up inside of the TV station. Mm-hmm. No real way out except, you know, the hole that they fucking drove through the TV station, you know?
Where there isn't a door, you create one.
You create one, right? But now they've left themselves cornered, basically, and like the Yeltsin forces basically just fire upon all these civilians. It's like a pretty much a slaughter, a massacre. They kill a couple foreign journalists who are caught in the crosshairs as well. And like all the civilians at the Ostankino TV station, this is from Lobacheva, they're like misrepresented by Yeltsin as like a dangerous, well-armed mob of like quote-unquote red-brown terrorists who had been like ransacking the TVs, which they did drive a truck into the side of it.
I mean, they just...
But there were also like children there as well. So it's like, I don't...
I mean, yeah, that's a classic. Like,
hey, it's a thorny
they're
one.
All terrorists.
And then on October 4th, the next day, October 4th of 1993, like the pro-Yeltsin tanks are mobilized. And there's some really famous photographs of like the tanks just rolling down the highway with their barrels pointed at the White House. And I'm pretty sure like the White House or Parliament is like burned down and it had like 5,000 people inside with about 1,000 to 1,500 on the nearby streets. And of course you've got the pro Yeltsin forces clashing with the pro Parliament forces in the streets, but the pro Yeltsin guys are backed by the riot police. And so there's just like an orgy of violence and looting into the night whereby the pro-Parliament guys are kind of literally rounded up. There's a purge of like officials and defenders of the White House and like the pro-Parliament civilians and everything.
Yeah.
Some are taken to detention centers, either established or impromptu. And some of those impromptu detention centers, one of which is the Krasnaya Preznia Stadium. So basically just like in Chile, where people are just being killed in a sports arena. a purge of, but it's not a new Russian regime without a good purge, you know?
Yeah, I feel like purge is often associated with like communist places.
Yeah.
And purge is fair game, dog.
Purge is ubiquitous, all right? It is common territory, all right?
Equal opportunity.
You know, you can purge, man. You can purge. I can purge. You can purge. She, we.
Everybody can purge.
Right?
I don't know why they always take them to, like, I don't know why, like, people like murdering people in sports arenas.
It's a thing, man.
It's a thing, man. Like, people love to get, they always see those, they had gridiron dreams. And they're just like, mm-hmm. I just want to be on the field. It doesn't matter that I'm murdering people.
It doesn't. I just, I wanted to walk this AstroTurf, right?
How many times do you get to get on the field, though?
How on many the times? Fields, right?
I could just murder these people anywhere, but uh-huh. I would mm-hmm. love to do it where I dreamed about as a kid playing soccer.
That's right.
That's what that's
those dreams never came true, but today they can. All right.
Yeah. Yeah, don't mind the bodies.
Don't mind the
bodies. Don't mind them. Don't mind
horrible.
Them.
Yes. Yeah.
Yeah.
It's something weird about it as well. Lobacheva mentioned that the amount of victims from the purge and just the coup, counter coup, depending on how you look at it, the amount of victims will probably never be known. Because the corpses of the opposition just start kind of like disappearing from Moscow morgues.
Well, yeah, that is a classic. I don't know if that's CIA or like the CIA doesn't own it, but like it's something you see in South America a lot. Look, can't be no discussion if there ain't no bodies.
If there ain't no bodies, man, if you never find the body, what body? What coup? What purge?
Guess what? Who I murder ain't nobody.
Uh-uh.
If there ain't nobody, how you gonna prove the murder?
If a tree falls in the woods,
yeah, classic.
Did you hack it down with a chainsaw? You know,
who's to say? Okay. And guess what? Did I hack down that tree? What if I just get in the helicopter and drop that tree off into other woods?
Mm-hmm. Like, mm-hmm. What if you just find the tree? What if I just throw the tree out into the sea, right?
Yeah.
And it ends up washed up on some beach somewhere.
Yeah, that's what I'm saying. Yeah, no. What purge?
I don't know how it got there, man.
Yeah.
But where's the bodies, though, right?
Yeah.
This is another like weird thing that I just don't know enough about, like, Russian attitudes, where my conceptualization of Russian people is that they're very like callous and that this is just like another day. But there's like been multiple books written about, I think all in Russian as well, by like journalists and historians and Russian politicians who are just like, this is horrible. And so, you know,
this specific incident,
and like Yeltsin's counter coup and everything. I think there's just a tendency to assume that like Russians are all cold, unfeeling robots, and it's like, no, these are people, you know. People's just people, right?
Yeah. No, I mean, this is, I think that whole like Eastern Europe, the Caucasus, they have a very like it's just like not a, they have dead eyes. But that doesn't mean like, yeah, they, of course, people still, especially when you go through something like this, it's like a purge, you're like, oh, it's an ordeal, it's just a tragedy, you know what I mean?
Yeah. For sure. And then this gets into Act Two of this episode, which I will call Behind Closed Doors.
Mm-hmm.
It's going to get juicy, all right? And the first thing I want to talk about with this one
hey,
is
man, don't ever get on this podcast talking about Behind Closed Doors. It gets juicy. I don't want to hear about what y'all got
you know
going
it does,
on
man.
At that love
you know
shackle.
It does, all right?
I don't see nothing wrong.
Okay, all right. Why are you singing R. Kelly? You know what?
I don't want to know what R. Kelly does behind closed doors. I kind of know what he does, but I don't know the entire story, right?
I think you're inspired by the myth behind the music.
Right. It's nasty. It's nasty. Anyway, first thing I want to talk about in this act is the rise of the mafia. And I wanted to cover this in the last episode, but we had a bunch of other stuff to look at. And of course, as with any mafia, there's money to be made and a little bit of racketeering, right? Mm-hmm. And then in this phase, especially because you have government cuts even before like the actual dissolution of the Soviet Union, during like the reforms and everything, if you're making cuts to the government budget, some of that implies like cutting the police force, and so there's like more room for organized crime. And the racketeering particularly comes into play in that people needed, they called it a krisha. I think I'm saying that correctly. Krisha or krisha? Probably krisha, which is like a roof. You know, roof protects you from the rain, right? And that's basically like protection. You know, protection with quotes or whatever. And Widmer says, Derek Widmer, the Swedish guy who was running around during the 90s, said that like people turn to the mafia a lot. Because, like, if a car was stolen and you reported it to police, they'd be like, oh, we'll look into it. If you reported that shit to the mafia, they would find it, right? Yeah. They would look for it. They would find it. Maybe they stole it. But also, I mean, maybe they didn't, right? Maybe it was somebody else. But unlike classic. The police, in contrast, they offered the services, you know?
Yeah, that's classic criminal behavior. The old, I stole it, and then I help you find it.
Right.
And then I charge a fee for helping to find
it. That's right, man. After I've sold all the best parts within it without your knowledge, right?
Or the other one of I stole it and then, oh, look, I have that thing that you need to purchase right here. Mm-hmm. And I sell it back to you.
Oh, man, I steal your car. It looks like you're in the market for a new car.
Uh-huh.
Good thing I just imported all of these Mercedes Benzes and I can offload them onto you. Like, yeah, that's. I didn't really think about it until now, but yeah, that's pretty...
These guys, look, they're very smart guys. They're very smart guys and gals. They're
making money. And a lot of the ranks of the Russian mafia at this time are swelled by, like, ex-KGB guys who now, like, don't really have a home and, like, veterans of the Soviet-Afghan War. So, you know, they're well-armed and have great training, right? Really good credentials.
Yeah, that's what happens, man. You got to really take care of those guys. People who know how to, like... All they know is like military top style shit. You really got to take care of them. Because it's what happened in Iraq where they're just like, they let all the Sunnis, they're like, when we came in, we invaded Iraq, and like the Sunni people, they like kind of let them, like, you guys aren't going to be as much in the government, have as much power, and be like all in the military. And then those dudes who got laid off of the military went to be just like, oh, now we're just going to become Al Qaeda.
Like, we're going to do it, man. We need to do something. We've got all this training.
If it comes to sectarian war, you know what I mean?
Let's get it going, man. Let's get it going, right? Let's get it started and high.
Okay, you gotta stop singing. I don't understand why you keep singing.
I'm a very musical man. I'm just not.
I've never seen this before. I don't want to see it again.
That's the thing. I have a lot of joy in my soul. I don't know if that comes across in this podcast.
I'm not even going to respond to that because I've never heard. You know what? I've never heard that.
So the biggest thing, or one of the largest things, is that, like, the newspapers during the 1990s are like always covering the deaths of high-risk individuals. In 1994 alone, there were 600 entrepreneurs, journalists, and politicians that were murdered. And so just you're... In Russia, you're in the 90s, and just every other day you see a newspaper on the stand that's like, this banker killed, this journalist killed, this state official killed, this random dude killed, and just like, okay, this is just what we're going through, right?
Yeah.
One of their other tactics is, or one that I found interesting, was that like a representative of a gangster's company would basically like go to the bank and... write up a contract for a loan, and the pretext of the loan is be like, oh, hey, I'm going to import a bunch of German beer or Latvian sausages or whatever the hell. And they would get the loan, and then they would take that money and convert it into foreign currency and then send it down a long chain of banks until it ended up in a Western bank account. And then kill the banker. That way nobody ever... So they're just basically kind of like looting the banks in a manner of speaking. You know what I mean?
I mean, efficient. I'm not going to lie, it's fucked up.
Yeah,
it's very fucked up, but efficient.
Mm-hmm.
Efficient, incredible, you know what I mean?
It made some people a lot of money, right?
Yeah.
But part of me also thinks, like, if you kill the banker, surely he would have written it down unless the consumer goods crisis was so bad that they didn't even have paper, and relying on memory. Like, oh, the
I go in on a fake ID. I go in with a fake ID. I say, hey, this is my different name, a different name from who I am. Uh-huh. You're the only person who's seen me or had real contact with me. So I just murder you.
Yeah, but surely he would write this down of, like, this amount of money went to this individual. You wouldn't need to kill the person. That's the part I don't understand, you know?
Hey, but the people are like, hey, that guy died after you handled this thing. Do I really want to investigate this thing?
Yeah, okay. There's the dual end of, like, hey, this is mighty suspicious that this banker died after giving this loan. Mm-hmm. And then on the flip side, which it's like, we both should and should not look into this murder. You know what I mean?
But also, like, they're doing, like, what, in 1994, they're doing 600 murders, 600 murders of high-profile people in all of Russia, or in all of Russia. That's not counting just your fucking scum fucks who are getting murdered. Your regular dudes that are getting murdered, your regular ladies, all the regular people that are getting fucking murdered.
Your random trees that wash up on a beach shore sometime, you know?
All the lovers' quarrels, the domestic violence, all that stuff is happening. And then some banker goes missing. You're the cop. You just go in just like...
And all of a sudden, the media... Yeah, the media just wants to talk about all these deaths.
I don't know what you're doing. I don't.
You know what I mean? There'll always be.
Yeah.
That guy, right?
Yeah.
And just to kind of show you also, like, just how far the free market permeated Russia and how deep it ended up laying its roots. It permeated, like, all aspects of life. And something I thought was kind of funny is that there would be, like, an entrepreneur who needed a Krisha. And the criminal organization supposedly, like, selling the Krisha, because they're really just, you know, racketeering, but selling the roof to him would keep on, like, increasing their rates of, like, hey, it was, you know, for example, 100 rubles. It's going to be 200 rubles this month, right? And they would keep on doing that so much to the point to where the entrepreneur would basically go to another area of the city and find another criminal organization and basically ask, like, hey, How much are you guys charging? Like, if I'm going to be extorted, what these guys are charging is through the roof, all right? If I'm going to be extorted, I'm going to be extorted at a fair fucking price, okay?
Yeah. Yeah, that's a, we're, see, that is a
competition.
High level,
that's a market high level. Competition, right?
That's what Adam Smith was talking about. I don't know.
That's the invisible hand, man.
Yeah, but then also, like, that's like the deep layer of capitalism, but there's a couple layers below that. Now, if it got really permeated through the entire society, then once you had that extortion, then there would be people selling that extortion, whether it's going to be fail or not, on some type of trading market.
Yes, exactly.
And then people would be betting on whether that extortion would fail or succeed.
Yes.
Now.
Speculation on extortion.
Yeah, that's now that's the last layer.
Wow,
that's final stage boss level capitalism.
You get
we're taking side bets on extortions on the Chinese market.
Yeah. I just got a shit ton of derivatives from this guy's murder. All right, don't ask how it works. I don't really know how it works. I know that I'm buying a Benz, man. That's what I know. Okay,
and I hedge that bet. I hedge that also on the casket materials of his funeral. And so I was covered.
Very good.
It's called diversity of my portfolio. I got,
yes,
I got
that's right.
Extortion. I got murder.
Yeah, I got coffins.
I got coffins. I also am invested in lollipops.
That's just more for me and the kids. You know, they just need. I wanted to do something fun for them. What else you could do? Is you take all of your bets, all of your speculation, all of your projections on those individual acts of extortion, and you combine them into a larger conglomerate of debts, basically, of bets, right? And you take that combined portfolio of whether or not all of these selected individuals get murdered as a result of being, or not get murdered, as a result of being extorted, and you take that combined portfolio
Yes.
And you sell it to somebody up the chain, right? Yes. You sell it at a loss compared to what you could make if you held out for all of those events to occur, but you get quicker profit in the short term, right?
But
you sell it up.
I'm hedging within that combined product that you're talking about. There are tranches within the product. These are good tranches. This guy's probably not going to get murdered. This guy's probably not going to get murdered.
Yep.
But
yes,
what he's expecting, this is the person I'm selling it to, the customer, is expecting for those bottom tranches to not have as much risk. But I have packed that bottom tranche
with all of these high risk. That's
high
right.
risk tranches that will then go belly up. And I will then make profit off of this because I'm betting that it will go belly up
because
on
the
other side.
Yes. Yeah, yeah. I'm flipping it up to them and I'm making more immediate profit and I'm putting all of these bad tranches inside of all of the, all of a sudden I have to decrease the barrier to entry to give somebody a loan that they would pay to the mafia to be extorted, right? All of a sudden there's a run on the extortion market, right?
And it's not my fault that the regulators or whoever has not looked at this product and reevaluated how much insurance you need to buy this product. And that's just not my fault. And
maybe you need a credit score. Maybe we need stricter credit requirements for who can pull out a loan in order to be extorted, right?
They're still ranking my product with all these bad tranches as triple A product. So and that's literally how the 2008-07 market crash.
We're gonna see a 1993 the speculatory bubble of it's gonna burst, man.
Yeah,
it's gonna burst and take down a lot of the biggest banks.
Okay, all right. I'm looking forward to it.
Right on. Okay. Might be the best thing we've ever done. I'm not gonna lie.
It really. We saw The Big Short. You can tell.
We saw The Big Short. We saw. Oh, come on! I know a guy in The Big Short. In The Big Short.
Yeah. Okay.
That's my claim to fame. I know a guy. I wasn't in the movie, but I know a guy.
That's all. Who? Yeah.
Anyway, December, 1994. So a little bit further down the. Down the line, fighting intensifies at Grozny, which is the largest city in the province or like state of Chechnya, which is a province or a state in the Caucasus, kind of near like Georgia and Azerbaijan and Armenia and everything. And all of those republics, nations now, have asserted their autonomy and been granted it. And I guess Chechnya like wants in on that as well. And so they... I think have been right because this is like the first Chechen war and I don't know like when it begins because they didn't really talk about it all that much, but I wanted to at least like kind of thread it through. And there have been like tensions and skirmishes in Chechnya and around Chechnya. I think like Chechen rebels are also just running around various parts of Russia. But in December of 1994, in the fighting in Grozny, which is the largest city in Chechnya, federal forces lose about 1,000 troops. So it's like a drastic upping of the stakes. And the insurgency, the Chechen insurgency or war rebellion, however you want to think of it, is led by Dzhokhar Dudayev, who I don't really know that much about him other than his name. And also like the Mujahideen are also involved somehow. Yeah. They're like running around being imported from like... Tajikistan are coming over from Tajikistan or Turkmenistan or one of them.
Chechnya is like very Muslim.
Okay.
Like a very Muslim. Like, so like the Mujahideen, like they're like a Muslim part of Russia. I mean, it's the Caucasus. So, but that the Chechenian whole, like the first Chechenian war and the preceding struggles that were happening in Chechnya. It's interesting. It's a whole episode within itself.
Yeah.
It's a lot of, Russia's going to go through its own bouts with terrorism. Bombs. I remember being like younger and something about the bombing of school children and stuff like that. I think a movie theater. I might be, it's a whole drawn out struggle with this. So the guy who leads Chechnya now, like I think his name's Ramzan or something. These people, they vice did a doc on him. They did a vice doc on him. I think it's interesting. They seem to like settled it now. Like there's not, Chechnya isn't as big of a deal for Russians.
Yeah.
In terms of, as internal like flare ups, But I just remember it being something seedy, but I don't remember exactly.
Yeah, I don't know because like for all three of these, none of them really talked about what was going on in Chechnya. So I was just like, okay.
Oh, it's like they're like, I mean, you say,
but it seems messy, you know.
It seems like I don't know if you say Afghanistan is their Vietnam, Soviet Union, yeah. Vietnam. It feels like this new Russian republic that is after Soviet Union, Chechnya. Is there Vietnam? Because they seem to lose a lot of people, and it's also like something that really isn't secure. It might be secure now, but it took a long time.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So the next major thing to happen, the next phase of privatization comes in March 1995, where Boris Yeltsin's government, it can't meet its budget. And so there's this guy, Vladimir Potanin, who's head of Onexim Bank. He proposes to Yeltsin, he's got this little scheme going on where he said, hey, let's get me, and who's the head of the Onexim Bank, one of the largest banks in Russia, let's get all of the other guys who like lead the largest banks or their officials or whomever, mm-hmm. let's get all those really wealthy bankers together, and we will make you a one-year loan, Boris Yeltsin, that way you can meet the government's budget, correct?
Yeah.
In exchange, the government is going to put up securities. And the way I understand securities, it's I kind of had to like dig into it. Mm-hmm. It's a certificate attesting ownership or like a thing, a guarantee of something pledged to be forfeited or given up in the case of someone defaulting on a loan. It's basically like an IOU. So if you're going to give me this loan, I've got this IOU here, which is a security, and if you default on it, I get whatever the IOU says right?
The collateral.
Yeah, collateral, exactly. Yeah. In 29 state-owned companies, and it's like mostly oil and mineral companies that they're putting up for auction. And if the government decided not to repay the loan by September 1st of 1996, which curiously is after the next Russian presidential election, the holders of the securities, so all the banker dudes, they would receive the promised shares, because that's what's on the securities, in these state-owned oil and mineral companies, right? Mm-hmm. And that would effectively privatize them, because they'd be taken out of government hands and they'd be given up to these private citizens. Yeah. And they'd be auctioned off in what were called these pledge auctions in November or December of that year, 1995. And there's some talk in the media between the banks, there's some talk between the banks, some talk, not in every instance, but because they're auctioning off these state-owned companies. Yeah. And so there's some like chatter between the banks of like, hey man, we don't really have to bid if we refuse to compete. We can all get what we want at the lowest price possible if we just come up with a compromise. And that happens in some instances, but not in every instance. Other properties or other businesses were a little more valuable, I suppose, or they just, they wanted them. And so it was more competition for them. And so it's framed as like a quote unquote, like a war of the banks in the media, all of the talking going on between all of them.
Yeah.
And then also while that's going on, in between the next two events, June 14th of 1995, there's a hospital captured by Chechenian rebels in Budyanovsk, which I think it's still, because you've got Western Russia and then you've got the Caucasus region. It's like in between the two, I think northwest of the Caucasus area. And there's like 2,000 hostages in this hospital. They demand like cessation of Russian military operations in Chechnya and open negotiations with Boris Yeltsin. And Yeltsin basically just dips. He's like, I'm out. I'm going to a fucking G8 summit or whatever to badmouth you guys. And he's like, Viktor Chernomyrdin, the prime minister, you got it? And Chernomyrdin's like, yeah. And he goes and negotiates their release. And he actually like pulls it off. And it's like the way Heroes of the 90s tells it, it's like a huge PR victory for Chernomyrdin. It's one of his finer moments.
Yeah.
Just to show you that it's still going on, but like 2,000 hostages is no small ordeal, you know?
Yeah, that's not chill.
That's not chill. February 1996, the communist. I don't know if he's like a leader of the he's one of the leaders of the Communist Party, but I don't know what his specific position is. This guy, Gennady Zyuganov, he speaks out against the current state of the Russian economy publicly, and he claims that the Russian economy is being drained by corrupt bureaucrats and mafia guys. And so he's kind of pointing the finger at the people responsible for this like large pillaging or pilfering of the Russian economy. But do you want to be pointing your finger at these guys is the question, right?
Yeah, I mean, especially with 2 years ago, they're doing 600 people.
600 murders a year we know of?
People
like,
of
Jesus.
Importance. Not just in total. Just noteworthy people.
Yeah. In the same month, the super rich, they basically hold this private meeting and they all agree to throw the weight of their political power behind Boris Yeltsin to ensure that Zhuganov isn't elected president, because they assume, probably rightfully, that they just got this deal with Yeltsin, the whole pledge auction thing and everything, and that if Zhuganov gets elected, their agreement might be nullified. He might have he might have something else in mind, you know. So they decide to protect their interests.
Yeah.
April 27th of 1996, the Letter of 13 is published, and it's like the first kind of existing document of the ruling elite, known as like the Seven Bankers Cabal.
Yeah.
And they say that the politicians. Here's the direct quote. Is, you want me to do it in a Russian accent, or should I do it?
I don't want you to try. Please don't try. Just do it in your
must mind. Understand that Russian entrepreneurs have all the resources and willpower required in order to influence both the politicians who are too unscrupulous and the ones who are too uncompromising.
Okay.
So they're basically throwing the gauntlet down. And they're saying, like, hey, we have everything's on the table here with this deal. If something gets fucked up, everything is on the table, right? Don't fuck this up, please.
This is like an interesting example of like thing I've been thinking about. Like, I guess I just don't remember from history class, where it's like you have pillars of power, and everybody always talks about like the military. They talk about like the royal, the government, and then they talk about the church, you know, especially, you know.
Yeah.
Yeah, they always talk about that. But nobody ever talks about like one of the pillars of power being the economic, like the business community. And like, it's just like this example, like how they have this way, like, look, we're a power.
Yeah.
We've risen up because of the privatization of this economy, and we have resources, and we can make this shit. We want to be respected and have.
We can make things really fucking hard for you.
Yeah.
All right.
Yeah.
We can make this a tough time.
That's the same shit that the church would say when they would be like, oh, you don't want to fill the coffers of the church?
Uh-huh.
Okay. Well, guess what? You're an illegitimate child and you're never baptized. Yeah.
You're a heretic.
And you're not. Now people shouldn't follow you because you don't.
Now there's a bunch of people with pitchforks. Pitchforks and torches, and they're coming for you, man. But I mean, you go to the transition from the church to the businessman. That's because money is our god, bro.
Yeah,
it's because money is the new god, man. It's all the businessmen are the new high priests of the nation. All right, brother. All right, man.
The regular voice that you have.
No, because then I would sound like a dipshit. If I want to both get the thought out there, but also point out that like. Okay. Okay.
That's a valid.
But I mean, it's also.
No, I
like,
know, I know. I, yeah. I'm
pinky up, I'm tip my fedora to you, sir, you know?
Yeah. No, it's, yeah, but I thinking of like, especially in America, I mean, we do think about it. I just feel like it's not as pronounced as, but all right.
Yeah, they basically just out themselves like, hey, we're a bunch of super wealthy, well connected.
Yeah.
Individuals, and we will kill a politician if they we will not hesitate to fuck you up.
Yeah, we have the money and the resources to murder people. So
And the fact that they're like not because a lot of shit happens behind closed doors everywhere. You just have money and power in proximity. Deals are going to be made, but the fact that they would just publish a letter in a newspaper is kind of It's pretty crazy because we would like freak out, but
in gangster films, you put the gun on the table, signifying that I have. But in this letter is the business class in Russia in the 90s, not putting a gun on the table, just putting their full penis and balls on the table.
Yeah, through a press release. Yeah. Right, that's how you do it.
Yeah, yeah.
June 16th of 1996. Yeltsin is reelected with 35% of the vote, so he got a plurality, not a majority, and he was in bad shape before. Like, he lost a lot of good graces of the public, I think primarily with the coup. Like, you know, he wasn't doing great. He was doing okay after shock therapy. I from what I've read, it seemed like he was largely forgiven. But then after the coup, it was like, oh no, this guy's a fucking asshole, you know. And so he was at like 5% support at one point. But it just goes to show you how strong the media or the support of the fucking seven bankers cabal and the letter 13 and everything. They threw their way behind him and he won, right? And then he goes on to name Vladimir Potanin, the head of the Onexim Bank. He becomes deputy prime minister.
Yeah.
And so you got the head of one of the largest banks also is deputy prime minister. Did we ever really leave the era of stagnation is the question, or do we still have these bloated, corrupt bureaucrats who are making money off the exploitation of the state? You know, it's still capitalist. Yeah, it's capitalist. It's not communist anymore. It's capitalist, but the result is the same. You know,
the problem isn't necessarily the systems, either system. It's the exploitation.
Agreed.
People.
Agreed.
Yeah. So I definitely have my like issues and my like point of view, but like in this specific example, the people are gonna people are exploiting.
Yeah.
Point blank. Like. Yeah.
So another thing that helps Yeltsin get reelected is honestly U.S. interference. You know, you hear a lot about like Russian meddling in the U.S. elections. Probably most famous example of the opposite. Three advisors were sent in February of 1996, and the U.S. like
advisors,
right? Exactly.
Quotations around that are advisors. Mm-hmm, one of them niggas worked for CIA. One of them dudes.
Maybe. And the U.S. like urged the IMF to give the Russian government a $10 billion loan.
Yeah.
That way Boris Yeltsin could basically give everyone their back pay that had been stalled for a while. But, you know, you're not really, you're basically bribing the citizenry in a manner of speaking. I mean, they were owed the money, and it's not like as explicit as like, you'll get this money if you vote for me, but it can't hurt.
I mean,
surely cannot hurt, right?
The idea of of course, like people getting angry, Americans getting angry about Russian interference in our elections. It's of course,
rightfully so.
Rightfully so, but like we do that to every country.
We're all high and mighty, like we're our democracy has been tainted when we fucking rub our taint all over other countries' democracy. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
And there are also some, I've read somewhere, I don't know how well substantiated this is, that like Bill Clinton and Boris Yeltsin had conversations. They seem like they were buddies, honestly. Yeah. I'll post a picture. It's kind of funny.
Yeah.
And there's a fucking movie about this. It's called Spinning Boris. It was released in 2003, and it stars Jeff Goldblum. And how weird is it that our like, in America, our international crimes star Jeff Goldblum, you know what I mean? That's kind of it's kind of nuts. I imagine it's like the death of Stalin of its time, you know.
I do not want to give it that much because look, man, that's a good movie, and I've never heard of Spinning Boris.
But Death of Stalin is a good movie, but I want to see Spinning Boris. Maybe we could all watch it together, right? Our listeners could watch it. We could watch it.
I'm looking at the cover of it, and I'm not gonna watch it.
Doesn't look great. I'm a Jeff Goldblum man. All right,
a lot of people are dog. A lot of females love Jeff Goldblum.
He's a good man.
I don't know him personally. You know what I mean?
I actually don't. He's a good actor. Let me say that.
Yeah.
I enjoy his work.
Okay.
So this gets into Act 3 of our episode entitled Tidying Up. September 1996, Yeltsin decides that the government In fact, would default on the loan provided to them by the largest banks via the pledge auctions and the security shares and all that stuff. And so the banks cash in all of their securities and they become like majority shareholders in a lot of these companies. And so now the end result is that like some of the largest banks also become some of the largest mineral and oil companies. Mm-hmm. And those are the oligarchs. Like yeah. Oligarchs pre-existed in Russia before this, but if any one incident kind of defines the rise of the oligarchs, I think it's this.
Yeah.
Because they just have like morbidly large commercial empires, like yeah. fucking massive, like many factories. How, like, the flip side of this is that a lot of these state-owned factories are operating with like outdated equipment because yeah. Brezhnev spent all this oil money. Uh-huh. Not investing inside of the state, but in building nuclear weapons. Yeah. And so they need improvements. Yeah. And all these factories that they're now majority shareholders in, it's going to take longer for them, those businesses, to turn a profit than they initially thought. Yeah. And it's speculated that the oligarchs like came to realize that they kind of need the state in order to get these factories operational because they're going to be operating at a loss for such a long time. And so, but on the flip side, the state, rather than like totally divest itself of these interests, it's going to have to keep these companies afloat to make sure there's not like massive unemployment yeah. and everything. And it might be free of like the daily operational obligation,
yeah.
but it's also free from the potential profits.
It's called corporate welfare.
Yes. Yeah.
You know what I mean? Just propping up companies so that they can, so that you can maintain some type of the economic system that you want to. Like, well, Walmart's my best example here.
Like, yeah.
most of the people who work at, like, not most of the people, but there's a good percentage of Walmart workers that are on welfare.
Mm-hmm.
That means we're subsidizing them to have workers. We're subsidizing Walmart's workforce by paying the other half of their living expense. Because if we didn't pay that, then Walmart couldn't, those people have to get in their jobs because they fucking, if we did have welfare, if they weren't on welfare. You understand what I'm saying?
Yeah.
Yeah, I mean, so this is another example of that. Just
just crushing, you know, just like,
yeah,
all right, cool.
It's, yeah, I mean, it's everywhere. It's everywhere, big dog.
Yeah, but the interesting thing about the two phases of privatization, the one we talked about last time yeah. and then this episode, is that the second phase of privatization in Russia, there is a much higher barrier to entry. You know, at first it was vouchers, and vouchers were given to private citizen. And even those kind of trickled up, right?
Yeah.
And now this second phase of privatization
yeah.
is it's just a couple dudes, really. Yeah. I couldn't tell you how many, but compared to like every Russian citizen is getting one of these vouchers mm-hmm. to now like, all right, there's maybe like, I want to say like 100. 100 of you guys are going to be able to buy these state-owned businesses. And so you see this immense stratification of wealth.
And this is like prime era. I mean, this isn't like the 80s, but like this is like prime era, like neoliberal, like kind of, we're not going to say trickle down, but we mean trickle down.
We mean trickle down. Yeah. Trickle down's been discredited, but we still like the idea.
We still just do trickle down. We just don't call it trickle down.
Yeah. Like, yeah. But by trickle down, they mean trickle up, right? Yeah, that's kind of yeah. what the whole thing, the yeah.
But here's the thing about that trickle. There's a gutter, but that gutter is stopped up with leaves, so all that mm-hmm. all that water just stays mm-hmm. up here. Dog.
Mm-hmm. I like that. I like the metaphor. I don't like the.
Oh, I'm just no. I'm full of metaphors thing, all the know? Time. That's all I got.
So along with the rise of the oligarchs, naturally another industry that kind of pops up around them, like another avenue for other entrepreneurs, mm-hmm. are like private clubs and high fashion boutiques that catered exclusively to the ultra wealthy, right? And like some of those clubs and boutique owners naturally become ultra wealthy themselves because mm-hmm. these super rich people they don't want to fucking drink at the same bars as their dad, you know, like fuck that. I want to party. I want to fucking let loose, you know?
Yeah, man. Russia is, and Moscow specifically is like fire ass nightlife. I've never been there, but I've heard.
I've heard. I can only imagine, right?
Yeah, I mean, just a lot of models seem to also be Russian.
Yes. Yes, and yeah.
But they're vaguely angry.
Yeah. 1997, the Russian economy kind of stabilizes. The mad speculatory scramble is more or less over. The companies turn their interest towards like developing and manufacturing because now it's time to grow what we've bought, right? And to like turn a profit, let's build something, I guess. Yeah. And they become more interested as a result in like not fringe services. What's the word? And like liberal services. Arts, what we would think of the service industry service broadly. Industry. Yeah. It's like, you know, liberal arts and like journalism and PR and marketing and branding experts and everything. Yeah. So there's like a new demand for what we would think of as the middle class. And then also at the other end, like the more mom and pop type things, now that people are like no longer expected to just do a job because the state gave it to them.
Yeah.
The shopkeepers and like business owners start learning to like be friendly and pretend pretend to give a shit about the customers.
I don't believe this one.
Because this is from Heroes in the 90s. Let me be clear.
From that book, they
mention that like all of a sudden people are like competing because they want people to like their shop and come back and have a good experience. And so they start like smiling. You know?
But that's not, but like,
because good customer service is a competitive advantage.
But that doesn't work here. We don't do that here. And we're like if you go into a gas station, you get that stale ass gas station approach that you always get. so the dude behind the gate is like, hey, nobody's doing that.
It depends on where you look. But what about like Chick-fil-A? You know,
they got a lot
of things going for them, but their customer service is definitely something that helps keep them afloat. You know,
I mean, that's like one example. You go like, you still go to Popeyes and still a stale ass attitude at Popeyes.
I'm fine with that. I prefer a stale ass attitude.
Yeah,
honestly.
Like
I'll be
just saying,
I'm not happy. I don't want
the idea that these motherfuckers all of a sudden got nicer. Like as a broad thing, like it was like everybody was just like, because I mean, of course, there's gonna be people that realize like, okay, my customer service, I can gain a competitive advantage.
Yes.
But across all of it, nah. It does seem
more anecdotal than it does. Like here's the graph. Smiles per capita. Exactly.
That's more of a what's that? Yeah, that's an anecdotal evidence. I can't say that isn't true. I can't say it. But I push back against it.
But it's dubious. A little dubious. But you know. It's
no,
there.
No, no,
it's
no,
there.
No. You read the books.
Market penetration. Yeah, you know, penetration of that market, all right?
Yeah.
Spring of 1998, there are rumblings that the ruble would collapse soon, and there are, you know, some Russian dignitaries sent to Washington to negotiate yet another loan from the IMF. They secure it for the amount of $24 billion. And so June, the first part of that loan is transferred, $4.6 billion, but the treasury bills are like too high. And in order to make like the high weekly interest payments on that IMF loan, the government just had to like keep printing more money, and maybe they can find some short-term loans, but they don't find enough, or all the short-term options have dried up. And so August 17th in 1998, the ruble collapses again. And the reason being, I think, or just like, the way I understand it is like there's a quick influx of capital and then flight as some international investors make like very quick returns, and some like people within Russia make quick returns, but particularly explaining like the capital flight, particularly like the Swiss guy, you know, he talks, that's how he made his money. Derek Widmer is he just goes in there and he kind of buys up the shit and he middlemans it kind of the whole time and then sells off to somebody larger and makes money that way. That happens with a bunch of people, like internationally, you know, they pull money out of the Russian economy. So you've got a very volatile market in the 90s, and the government is handing out like short-term loans to people and businesses in order to cover their deficits to prevent the collapse. But it all kind of like, it all seemed to coalesce in August of 1998, which resulted in the collapse. You know, everybody came calling of like, hey, where's my money? And they kept on printing it and printing it, resulting in further currency devaluation. And then it's like, oh shit, well,
yeah,
it just fucking tanked, you know?
Yeah, yeah. And they're not like in a position to like really control how much money, how much their money, how like on, they're not like a, like the U.S. dollar is like a little bit different, like because it's like the backer of everything and people.
Yeah.
But like the ruble, fuck the ruble.
Yeah. Another thing is that I, again, the way I understand it is that the loans had been too frequent and too large, and it fuels like a huge amount of growth in a quick period of time. But again, it kind of similar to the second phase of privatization, production wasn't stimulated quickly enough to ensure that these businesses and the government can pay off the debts that they have and the interest on those debts themselves. And so particularly the private businesses, they need government support, which again results in more and more printing and yada yada. At one unnamed expert in the Heroes of the 90s book, they mentioned, he said his quote about the era generally is that the biggest lesson they learned is that more can be achieved with people than with money.
Go ahead, sorry.
I was gonna move on to the next point.
I was just gonna say, like, it's not the spending of money that's like necessarily the issue. It's like what are you spending that money on?
Yeah.
And if you're just giving that money to richer people to like kind of figure it the fuck out, you know, they might keep it. They might invest it in something wrong. They might, you know, but if you're giving that to like the people, and they're gonna spend it, and that's usually gonna. I think that stimulates an economy better.
I think trickle up is an economic fact.
Yeah.
And so you have to enforce trickle down, you know? You have to clear the leaves from the gutter, so to speak, to ensure that money trickles down so it then can trickle up, and then you've got fluidity and there's more stability there. I mean, I guess there's stability and stratification, but that only works for very few people, you know?
Again, we're assuming that those leaves are natural, that those leaves weren't put there by somebody.
Yeah,
saying,
that's also true. Those leaves are natural leaves and not made out of steel. You know?
Yeah. That's just the gutter doesn't go anywhere. It just stays all up there.
So, like, in sum, the whole period Russia in the 90s, there's like a huge capital flight with like oligarchs and foreign speculators. Understandably, don't trust the new Russian market. So they make their money real quick with, you know, quick returns, and then convert it into foreign currency and offshore it, because again, fuck the ruble. It's estimated that between 200 and 500 billion left the country between 1993 and 1998, and the government's just printing more and more money in order to offset that capital flight, and it just tanks. And then the Russian economy really begins to rebound, I think, in like the late 90s, early 2000s, via the sale of oil, but there's kind of this flip side, which is like now we're not monoculture, but it's not really culture. It's like you're exporting one raw good. And so oil. your market is more subject to, you know, fluctuations of the price of oil.
You don't want to be an oil economy.
No, you got to diversify that portfolio, man.
Yeah, diversify. Just like what did Wu-Tang Clan say in Wu-Tang Financial in that famous Dave Chappelle sketch? You got to diversify your portfolio, bitch. That was the sketch, I think. Or it was diversify your stocks and bonds, nigga. It was either one of those two. It's a good sketch.
So the end of Boris Yeltsin's presidency is racked with like financial scandals. He becomes less interested in like exerting executive authority after the collapse of the ruble. August 9th of 1999, Vladimir Putin is appointed acting prime minister by Boris Yeltsin. December 31st of 99, Yeltsin, he just basically abruptly announces his resignation. Putin becomes acting president, with elections being scheduled for March 26th of 2000.
Yeah.
Putin wins 53% of the vote on a law and order campaign directed mostly at the Chechen insurgency. Mm-hmm. And the same day that he like takes off, or I think the same day that Yeltsin resigns and Putin becomes like temporary acting president before he wins the election, December 31st, 1999, that day, Putin announces via presidential decree that corruption charges against Yeltsin would not be pursued.
Yeah. Yeah, and this next period of Russian history is incredibly interesting. The rise of Putin, like he's risen at this point, but like,
yeah,
it's like
I tried to find some more stuff on him, but all I could find is that he just kind of like crawled out of St. Petersburg. FBS. What's KGB? Formerly,
now it's the FS. It was the FSB. He was in Poland, from my understanding, like at towards the end of like the Soviet Union, and then kind of like comes back as this FSB kind of like agent.
Yeah.
And then he rises through the government. His stuff is the next period is interesting because it's, I feel like with Yeltsin, the business people owned Yeltsin, and they kind of ran him.
That is very true.
Putin flips that fucking script where he runs the oligarchs.
He fucking runs those guys out of Russia. He's like, hey, I'm gonna unleash the hounds against you. All right.
And it's not for like a good reason to be like, oh, we're trying to get that all the try to stop capital flight and all that type of stuff and keep them, you know. No. He's doing it. So he's like, you got to pay me.
Mm-hmm.
You got to pay me.
Yeah. Now. And he, like, the rise of Putin and what Putin does to Russia, how he kind of transformed. You can argue that maybe it was like an authoritarian hellscape in the 90s, but he really kind of refines it. He really figures it out.
Things are going to get a lot more Christian. And things are going to get a lot more homophobic, and things are going to get a lot more violent. I think less violent from the 90s. I don't know. I have no idea about the
I don't know. That's the other thing is I've mentioned it a couple times. Just I'm curious about Russia generally because there's a tendency to assume, again, the Russians are very like cold and callous, or moreover that they like.
Yeah.
All love Putin, or that Putin speaks for all of Russia, and it's like, no, there's a number of people in Russia who are like want Western democracy and want Putin dead, but there are also a bunch of people who think Western democracy is like a massive joke. So I just don't know.
It's incredibly like
disaggregating Putin from Russia is, I guess, what I'm trying to get at.
Yeah,
that needs to be done.
That's a deeper, longer conversation. But you have your Alexei Navalny's, you have your kind of pro anti Putin kind of people, and then you have like your whole like liberal kind of class of like younger people who are wanting, because Putin's kind of, he took the church again, that pillar of power. Mm-hmm. And like he's took in the business class, like, and he's combined, like, where he's very like the socially conservative, like there's like a lot of homophobic laws that they've passed in Russia, like it's whereas, and that's on the complete opposite, but people like hate him just for that. But then there's also like a contingent of like motherfuckers who are like they just want Russia to be great again, like that whole vibe.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? And But it's
about Putin daddy, you know?
Yeah. There's a lot of economic stagnation and shit. So, like, he's kind of fucked right now because oil's been down and they're an oil economy. So, like, he's not providing the jobs, you know what I mean, to make it semi, you know, workable.
Livable.
But, make people still be like, yeah, I fuck with Putin, but... Other than on the social shit, so that's why they like push a bunch of like homophobic laws recently. I'm pretty sure.
Yeah, culture war stuff to distract you.
Culture war
from what's really going on.
Yeah, because ain't nobody making no money.
Nope.
Because the sanctions and shit. If I'm correct, I might be mistaken the time period. But yeah, guys, we want to thank you for listening. That is our part two and conclusion of our Russia in the 90s. Deep dive. Thank you, Henry, for doing the research on that one. Thank you.
Of course.
Guys, we appreciate you listening to us. We appreciate you fucking with us. We appreciate you watching us. So please, again, follow, like, and share all our stuff. You can find us at Hard Fight History on Instagram and Facebook, HFH Podcast on Twitter, Hard Fight History on YouTube. You can find me at Joshua B. Stokes on Instagram and Twitter, Joshua Stokes on Facebook. Henry, where can they find you?
I'm just Henry Price on IG and Henry Price on Facebook.
Again, guys, thank you for coming and hanging out with us, kicking with us. Thank you for listening to us. Mm-hmm. Please like, share, subscribe, do all that stuff. And we'll see you next time. Okay?
Mm-hmm.
All right. Peace.
Peace.